Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast, the bi-weekly show from London's home of big thinking. I'm Vas Christodoulou. Sam Knight is one of the New Yorker's finest writers, and now the author of a book telling a bizarre story from 1960s Britain that is on the cusp of science and science fiction. It's called The Premonitions Bureau, and he joined David Malone to tell us more. Sam is also joining us live on stage in a couple of weeks to interview Michael Lewis, the author of The Big Short and Liar's Poker, about his amazing life and career. If you'd like to come, use the discount code HowToPod at the checkout page. That's HowToPod, all in caps, for 20% off. And without further ado, here are Sam and David.
How did you get onto the Premonitions Bureau? Well, tell us what it is and how the heck you discovered it.
So Premonitions Bureau kind of, in essence, was an experiment. It was a small-scale experiment, mainly between two men, a psychiatrist named John Barker and a journalist, Peter Fairley, who was the science editor of the Evening Standard. And the third kind of really important person was a woman called Jennifer Preston, who was Fairley's assistant at the Evening Standard. And she collected premonitions from the British public. And so the experiment ran for a relatively short period. It was kind of really active for about 18 months. And it ran sort of housed within the Evening Standard. And the idea was to ask the British public for their dreams and visions and kind of presentiments of the future, and then to kind of log those against events as they occurred and to see how many became true or came to pass. Yeah, so that was the experiment kind of in and of itself. And I first stumbled across the words, you know, the Premonitions Bureau a little while ago now. It was kind of, you know, 6 or 7 years ago. And it was literally a mention in one of those kind of 20th century guides to the paranormal, world of strange wonders kind of books. And it was just this fleeting reference to this experiment, which kind of just sounded like a bit of hokum, a fortune teller on the pier kind of thing, a sort of flimsy thing. But nonetheless, the name and the concept was so sort of attractive that I, you know, became like intent on finding everything I could about it. And I think the key that unlocked it for me was the figure of Barker. You know, he wasn't a crank. I mean, he had some extreme and unusual ideas, but he was a serious practicing psychiatrist. He was helping run a large mental hospital. You know, he had hundreds of patients. He was a proper progressive psychiatrist at a time of kind of great change in the field. So I was like, hold on, this isn't, there might be something here.
Mm-hmm. And he is an interesting cat, because as you say, he was coming into the psychiatry at a time when people were still dropped off and left to rot in those great big Victorian asylums. And he was one of the people saying, we can do better than this. So he's a very, as you say, a very progressive figure. And yet has this other side to him, which seems looking back as if we're so much better than that now. But he wasn't alone. I mean, in the book, you mentioned J.B. Priestley and the Evening Standard and Hugh Weldon at the BBC. They all took an interest, didn't they? So it wasn't, was it countercultural? What was it?
So I think, you know, we're talking about a sort of strain of mid-20th century British intellectual culture in which ideas now that seem very far apart were able to kind of rub alongside each other in respectable people's minds, if you see what I mean. In Barker's, you know, Barker is a real, he's got a foot in both worlds, as many people, you know, around at that time did.
Is there a connection? I mean, it doesn't figure in the book, but you say it's very English, and the story is wonderfully English, well, British. But there was also all that CIA stuff about the men who watched goats, and I mean, it wasn't just in the UK, was it? There was something going on that people thought the mind might be capable of much more than we thought.
Certainly. So there was remote viewing and kind of other CIA kind of sponsored experiments in America. And then there's also less well-known but parallel experiments taking place in the Soviet Union along similar lines. There's clearly kind of something in the air. I mean, I think it's kind of impossible to sort of make a solid theory on this, but we're talking about a time of dramatic social and technological change. And I think, you know, this clearly something similar takes place in the kind of 1890s through to the First World War with the founding of the Society for Psychical Research and telepathy and mediums. And that's, you know, a really nice thing that kind of stayed with me while I was doing my research is that, you know, telepathy comes from the same roots as the telegram and the telephone. You know, the 19th century was this time of technology radically changing people's relationships with each other and what was possible, and therefore, you know, to be on the frontier of finding the next thing about the human mind didn't seem as far-fetched as it feels now. And in the 60s, it's arguable you've got something similar taking place. You know, Peter Fairley, this the showman of the experiment, if you like, you know, presented the moon landings on ITV, literally going between rifling through the predictions sent in by the British public to going to watch the launch of the, you know, Jupiter rockets in Florida to take man to the moon. So he's these things existed, as I say, just right alongside each other in a way that is kind of, you know, it's kind of hard to imagine now.
Yes. But I mean, you say, what was it, page 143, our propensity to see objects which are not there, perceptual hunger, that's a lovely phrase, of perceptual hunger, increases as we feel less and less in control of what is happening to us. And that's really a lot of what's going on, isn't it? And that hasn't gone away.
No, I agree. And that phrase and that part of the book that you're referring to is a really nice paper in 1977 where some Soviet psychologists studied the reactions of parachutists, and what they did is they presented them with random dots or dots with numbers hidden in them, and they found that people were best, they spotted most acutely where the numbers were when in the kind of early stages of the flight, so when your adrenaline's up, your heart's going, plenty of oxygen flooding around the body, you see things very clearly, and people were most likely to see shapes that weren't there just as they were about to jump out of the plane. So just a moment where stress carries you into seeing patterns and seeing meaning, which isn't necessarily there, which I think kind of most people can sort of intuitively relate to.
But also, as you say, both of your central characters, they've got one foot in what we would call respectable science and then one foot in this other. But you say in your book, there is a link between looking for hidden patterns and making hypotheses. So making you in both cases, you're trying to make predictions about the future.
Yeah.
So it's not so strange that they, because they are doing it just in different ways in the two parts of their lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes me think of a couple of things. And the first, which is, you know, a bit mischievous maybe, but is about we hold up science, at least I do, you know, hold up scientists and doctors and other kind of, you know, overtly rational people as following, you know, the scientific method or being kind of highly skeptical or sort of ultra rational when faced with the world. But of course, they're just the same as us. They want to see something that no one's ever seen before. They want to be the one to proclaim some new impossible theory. Do you see what I mean? They're just as prone to sort of delusions and patterns that aren't maybe there as the rest of us. And Barker in particular for me is an intensely kind of human and relatable person for that reason. But also, you know, I think, you know, things like premonitions, as soon as you sort of say the word, that belongs in a certain category of the culture, whereas, you know, things like intuition or people on Wall Street or in the City of London who somehow have a feeling something's up and, you know, move before the rest of the market from basing some hunch on scrappy evidence or possibilities are kind of hailed as seers and, you know, important people to be listened to. Do you know what I mean? There's a way in which these things are kind of judged according to the context in which they take place.
Yes, I mean, you're right. There's a sort of continuum of words which they go from entirely acceptable through to things where you're going, oh, they just say a hunch, that's fair enough. Yeah. An intuition, you know, and then you've got people who have inspiration. That's okay. Maybe revelation would start to ring a few bells.
and there's a point where it becomes, you know, actively harmful and bad for people. Yeah.
Tell us about some of the, I mean, I just have to say the way you wrote the book, I just want to ask, you write it in what I think is a very, very clever way, in that you play around with the timeline. So you introduce strange notions and strange people, and then it takes a while to work back to why they're there and why, how they're so strange. And it has it's a very good way of writing the book, because you get drawn into these people's worlds. I mean, they're like Miss Middleton. What a wonderful character. I mean, she's right out of Jane Austen. Tell us about Miss Middleton.
That's
a fun character.
No, and the book starts with her, and there's a reason why I wanted the book to start with her. So the Premonitions Bureau ran for about, as I say, kind of in active form for about kind of 18 months, and over the course of that time, there were two stars, if you like, and one of those was Miss Middleton. She was called Kathleen Middleton. She was a music teacher based in Edmonton in North London. She was born in Boston in 1914. Her parents were English, but lost everything in the Great Depression and came back to suburbia in the 1930s. And Miss Middleton had been a child performer. She went to like a distinguished music school in Boston. She was sort of a trained, you know, child performer. She lived out her days as a well-known and, I'm going to hesitate to say beloved, but sort of respected neighbourhood figure in Edmonton, running this music school out of the house where she lived with her parents for 30 or 40 years. But she maintained her American accent and a certain glamour, a certain kind of poise. She sort of carried herself like someone who was someone. And she sort of carried this air of mystique and possibility. And the reason why I was able to write about her is because one of her pupils, a woman called Christine Williams, who started taking classes with her as a child, befriended her and then became her kind of friend and carer in her old age. And when she died, she kind of lovingly went through all of her possessions and letters and diaries. And so when I managed to track her down, you know, there was Miss Middleton sort of waiting for her story to be told. And I it was just really important to me to try and write about her and to write about everyone in the book as fully rounded people. There's a way to reduce someone like Miss Middleton to, you know, a cat lady. You know, she had a lot of cats, but she was also a person with a kind of full emotional life. Do you know what I mean? And I wanted to sort of, it was important to me that people start the book it's not so much taking people seriously, but trying to meet them where they are, I suppose.
Mm. And that works with Miss Middleton. But it's also the way that you've got this character who's sort of English whimsy, and then you pair it up with Abba Fan, which is anything but whimsical.
Yeah.
And so there's a wonderful contrast through the book between light and dark, the sort of the idiosyncratic English sort of strangeness, and then something which is very, very serious. And you pair this up the whole way through. You know, they weren't, the Premonitions wasn't about, you know, who's going to win Crufts.
Yeah.
They were all concerned with terrible disasters and could they be avoided? So they weren't frivolous people. They might seem frivolous in one way, but their interests were anything but frivolous. They were laudable interests.
Well, I think when I was researching the subject and, you know, and writing the book, there's sort of, yeah, there would be times where, like, is this all zany? Do you know what I mean? Is this frivolous, or kind of even in bad taste? You know, as you say, there's a number of, you know, very serious kind of disasters that I write about. You know, obviously Abba Fan, and then also a terrible fire that takes place in Shelton Hospital where Barker works. But when I would have these sort of moments of doubt, then there would generally be some moment where the story would, I hope, offer a glimpse of something which is maybe more universal or or starts coming into questions of our own mortality or the way that you and I make decisions about our lives and interpret chance happenings and whether you choose to act on them or don't choose to act on them. And so in my own researching of the subject, I'd be like, why am I reading through electoral rolls in the British Library, like house by house in Charlton, trying to find the relatives of Jennifer Preston, this assistant who collected all the things. And then there would normally be some moment where I would feel anyway that this does connect to some broader questions.
Hmm. And as you say that they were asking themselves deep questions. And I just wondered, I mean, I know you've said that you're not someone who believes in premonitions, and I don't think you've had any premonitions yourself, have you?
Not that I'm willing to talk about.
Fair enough.
No, you're right. Okay.
but yet, you cleverly, through the book, will talk about premonitions that people had, and that they're quite close in time to something that did happen. Did you ever find yourself going, oh, God, well, maybe? Because, I mean, like you, I don't believe in premonitions, but there was a whole section of the book where rapid fire that, you know, Miss Middleton thought this or somebody thought that, and then 2 days later this thing, or the very next morning, and I found myself going, oh, hang on a second. And then I'd say, no, wait, what am I thinking? But is there something in human nature that just would want to, or we're vulnerable to the thought or something?
Yes, I think is the short answer. I mean, a few things that kind of leap to mind hearing you talk there. I mean, I think it's interesting. You work, you know, I'm a magazine writer, you know, you work on different subjects. And when I was writing the initial version of this story for The New Yorker, and then when I was writing the book, people say, oh, you know, what are you working on? And you say what you're working on. And I normally wouldn't really be able to describe what this was about before someone started telling me about one of their own experiences or something that took place within their family and has become a kind of an important part of their own experience or their family's experience. And I think the truth is that many people live with coincidences or seeming glimpses of the future that are inexplicable, and they don't really know what to do with that. And it sort of exists as a kind of a tough little knot in your life that you can't really unpack or find a reason for. And I think a lot of people live with those inexplicable happenings and sort of don't particularly know how to respond to them. I mean, I think one thing that's really guided my sort of thinking about this, and there's a section in the book about the Western Isles of Scotland.
I was going to ask you about that.
Where second sight, and you know, seeing people at a distance, or seeing things before they happened, or seeing impossible sights, was fairly commonplace, or at least a kind of socially accepted happening through until the kind of the 18th century, more or less. And there's this wonderful bit of writing about it by a man called Martin Martin in the late years of the 17th century. And one of the fascinating things that he describes is that when people leave the Western Isles, the gift, the faculty, whatever it is, goes away. And then when they return to the Western Isles, it returns. And I think there's something really important about that, is that this is it's a social phenomenon. There's something about the idea of you being able to see something that's going to happen to someone else is, for me, fundamentally a kind of, it's an idea of a shared unconscious or a shared subconscious. And this is where you drift into Jung and other kind of mid-century kind of strong ideas about the workings of the human mind. And I, when I was writing the story, I thought often about that study of the Western Isles, and I came to think of the premonitions a bit like the Premonitions Bureau, a bit like a tiny island, a group of people, you know, had a shared belief that this was possible and this was happening, and that must have been tremendously exciting for them, but it was also unsettling and disrupting and, you know, and problematic and painful.
Yes, but I mean, you, again, there's a nice quote. You say, we see the world as our community sees it. We are drawn into each other's scheme of things.
Yeah.
And there is some truth to that. And then you sort of take that notion and you update it with more modern vocabulary. You talk about the nocebo.
Yeah.
The negative placebo. Tell us about that, because it was almost sort of taking that Western Isles from 1703 and saying, okay, let's look at a more modern version.
Yeah, so the nocebo effect is, as it sounds, it's the opposite of the placebo effect. It's most commonly observed during drug trials. So I give you a pill during a drug trial and I say, it probably won't happen to you, but some people, when they take this pill, they get an itchy leg or something like that. And when you warn people about the possible side effect, not surprisingly, a much higher proportion of people then develop an itchy leg during the drug trial. And it often, as I say, occurs in that kind of relatively benign form. And Barker was interested in the nocebo effect, and he was interested at the very extreme end, which is what happens if you tell someone they're going to die. Does that make it more likely to happen? Is there a sort of physiological component to negative expectations in our brain? Does that unlock other kind of physical responses to that? And there was this was named, potentially ill-advisedly, this was known as voodoo death. It was named in 1944 by Walter Cannon, a doctor at Harvard Medical School. And it's something that I, spoke to neurologists at Harvard now, this happens, extreme states of fear, you release hormones called catecholamines, they can overwhelm various sort of bodily organs. It's not as far-fetched as it seems. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, I mean, the whole notion of that people have sort of a psychosomatic illness, something which they bring on themselves, and it's shared, like the Havana syndrome, where all these Americans were saying, "My God, we're being targeted by acoustic weapons," and it was medically and physiologically and from the point of view of physics impossible.
Yeah.
Things they were, but and yet lots of eminent people were going, yeah, that must be right.
but it's again, it's shared into the skin. It's in, I write about, what's called resignation syndrome in Sweden, and that's one of the nice phrases used to describe this. It's an idiom of distress. It becomes a shared language of suffering, which is real.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Marquee TV. Marquee TV is an incredible streaming service that is a gateway to arts and culture. With my subscription, I've enjoyed watching some of the Royal Shakespeare Company's most acclaimed productions of recent years, including David Tennant in Richard II and Simon Russell Beale in The Tempest. I've seen multiple productions of The Ring Cycle and Thelonious Monk playing in Brussels in 1963. I've watched Alice in Wonderland at the Royal Opera House and Giselle at La Scala. Marquee TV really is the most accessible way into culture I've ever encountered, and a treasure trove for any arts lover. You can try it for 3 months for just 99p. Yep, 3 months for 99p. With the code HOWTO, just visit marquee.tv and use the promo code HOWTO to dive into the world of the arts like never before.
So in some sense, you're sort of sketching out the idea of premonitions as a shared idiom, a shared vocabulary of wanting to understand the world or control it.
Yeah.
And do you think there was something about the 60s and 70s? I mean, it was a time of a lot of change where old ways of saying, oh, this is where the way the world works, were being replaced.
Yeah. I wasn't there, so I can't speak for it, but it certainly feels that. It certainly feels that way. And I have to say, I don't write about it a huge amount in the book, but one of the sort of most important things that I read about and spoke to people who understand it much, much better than I do, and I'll probably kind of butcher it now, but is this idea of the predictive brain, which is sort of something that has sort of been increasingly important in neuroscience since the 1990s, which is that we don't receive experience passively, as it were, as it happens to us. Mm-hmm. Our brains are forming our responses and predicting our responses constantly. And in fact, and they write very beautifully about this kind of this cascade of predictions and memories going down to meet experience kind of as it happened. And I think, you know, premonitions and intuitions and feelings about the future just exist, you know, within touching of, you know, essential human ways of processing experience.
Yes, because in some ways, I forget what you say, but you say in some ways that the premonitions are a tantalizing version of something which definitely does exist, you know, the ability to make sensible predictions. And so it the structure of a premonition seems like something very real that has had lots of success in a slightly different guise, you know, just thinking, well, if I don't watch myself when I'm walking downstairs, I'll trip over. And so you make a prediction that you should watch what you're doing and it works.
And there seems like there is an almost universal kind of need or place for prophets in a culture that's not, you know, that's not particular to sort of any cultural tradition, you know, the idea that there should be some people who can see what's going to happen next.
Can you see it? Do you think it's really something of the past? Because like you say, it was there.
Yeah.
Sort of, well, certainly was there before World War One. And then you talk about how there was a whole generation of bereaved parents who were vulnerable. And I mean, those things which make people want to believe in premonitions or and those extra dimensions, that they haven't gone away. So it seems unlikely that we've suddenly become, you know, we've finally become the rational creatures that we always, you know, like to pretend we are. I can't really see that suddenly we have.
Well, I'm just kind of riffing here, but you know, you it seems that you see these waves, these moments where this kind of thinking recurs, and you know, who knows sort of what is the future of these ideas. But something that I really like about Barker is that, you know, his ultimate vision for the Premonitions Bureau was, you know, mass premonitions, you know, take it out of the Evening Standard and make it a kind of a national, he called it a central clearinghouse for the nation's dreams and feelings, and you'd be able to just call in from a telephone box or send your letter into some kind of freestanding bureau, and that ultimately you'd get these things in sufficient scale that you could feed them into a computer, and then a computer would look for peaks and patterns in the information and then be able to kind of generate, you know, an early warning based on this kind of confluence in the nation's in the nation's subconscious. And it's obviously very esoteric and strange and impossible, and yet to my mind it also does have a quite powerful resemblance to, you know, social networks and people's hunger to share their feelings. You know, there's a French thinker called Teilhard de Chardin, who's an amazing paleontologist and kind of French religious thinker. And he talked about human evolution heading towards some kind of global consciousness. And it's fascinating to me that we have made a global consciousness in the form of the internet. You know, if something happens in Japan in the next, you know, half an hour, you and I will know about it when we log off this call. We have found a way to share human feeling almost instantaneously on a huge scale among people. And so there's an aspect of, you know, when I was researching the story, it kind of just kept veering into, you know, the insane and the impossible, and then kind of back into like, oh wait, that, you know, that resembles something. You know, we know there's people feeding all sorts of, you know, sentiment analysis into Facebook and Twitter, trying to figure out the mood of people and the mood of populations. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, exactly.
These things kind of, I don't know. There are, well,
but you can see how that you could say, look, people's dreams and their professed premonitions. You don't have to say, I'm sure they're right, for them to nevertheless have a lot of information in them. I mean, if a whole nation started dreaming these sort of dire dreams of death, destruction, and doom. No. You wouldn't have to be Einstein to think there's obviously something going on in that culture that people are somehow not happy about. It just reminded me, there's a wonderful novel by a man called Kadare. I think he's Albanian, called The Palace of Dreams. And it's about a whole society and a whole bureaucracy that collects dreams for precisely this reason. They figure we must know what people are dreaming, because every now and then an important one comes up. It's a fantastic novel, and your book reminded me of it.
I'll get on it.
But we're talking about premonitions, and as you say, it's they're on one end of a spectrum. But like you say, what's so different between someone saying, "I just feel if we make a big push, if we make a big push on this today, the revolution will start." You know, like in Tahrir Square. Someone had the thought, now's the moment. We're gonna. It's not exactly a premonition, but it's not that far away, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I can help there, because so Peter Fairley, the journalist involved in the bureau, he gave a really he died in the late 90s, but he gave a really nice interview to the BBC in the late 70s, just talking about his career, and which was this career of you know, he coined the phrase, you know, the brain drain. You know, he wrote about hovercraft, you know, really like right there alongside sort of British industrial and kind of scientific progress in the kind of 50s, 60s, 70s, while, you know, maintaining a kind of healthy belief in, you know, extraterrestrial life and, you know, premonitions and things like that. And his definition of premonition, which I think is useful, and I kind of stuck to it for the book, is the feeling that you know something is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it feels like it already has. And it's not a nice feeling, because you don't know what to do with that information. And it suddenly just weighs on you. You've been given insight, and you know instinctively that most people won't listen to you or take you seriously, but nonetheless, you know. And I think that is the sort of, you know, to sort of help myself and help my thinking, because as you describe it, there is this spectrum, and it can be hard to draw the line somewhere. I sort of use that as my kind of guiding sort of rule when I was thinking about these things.
Yes, I mean, but what's, I mean, put that, you're right, that's a really good definition, because I could imagine, I don't know, some engineer who's looked at a Boeing plane and done the numbers, and in the middle of the night, his brain just says, if people fly this plane, it will crash. I know it's not good. And maybe at that moment, that engineer wouldn't be able to write it all out in the numbers and prove it, but his mind has figured out something. He just knows. And that's not ESP. Isn't it because your mind delivers answers to you, and you yourself can't go back and interrogate your own mind how you came to this? We have thoughts. We can't figure out how they came to us. They just come to us.
You know?
I mean, if I ask you what's, you know, the square root of 25, you'll give me the answer, but you don't know what the process was.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Listen, if you don't mind, I know it's earlier than normal, but there's someone's written in a question which is pertinent to what we're saying. It's by someone called Morgan. I am a futurologist who speaks to large multinationals, and I've been asked in the past if my forecast, bracket, often predictions, happen because people create that future reality in the collective subconscious because of what I've said, which is quite interesting. In other words, someone talks about the future, it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy if enough people say, that's right.
Which is a sort of, in a way, the opposite of the paradox that Barker and Fairley struggled with, which was, could they ever really prevent these things from happening? Because how can you see something which has been prevented? There would be no vision to precede it. So there are these kind of paradoxes that sort of I don't want to say drive people mad, but make, you know, are difficult to wrestle with in these questions of prophecies and how self-propelled they are. Yeah.
This person then goes on. There's the second half, which is interesting. In 2018, I was filmed speaking about 2020 and showed pictures of people in masks, hazmat suits, and showed an image of a virus. I did not know about COVID, but in my work, I show the future in a series of images and talk around them in the theme. My success rate is accurate, but I do not have premonitions. Now, what do you say to that?
Well, I'd say this person has the correct job title of futurologist. Yeah, rather than seer.
A futurologist, the difference, I suppose, is that you think, well, a futurologist knows about modern technology and knows about the kind of gain of function that's been going on in labs. And so, you know, they're extrapolating to the future. Okay. That's different from someone who is a dance teacher in Edmonton.
Yeah.
And says, there's going to be a fire in a hospital next week and lots of people are going to die and it's going to be like this.
Yeah.
Because one seems to be an extrapolation of expertise and the other just seems to go out of nowhere.
Yeah, to, you know, compare it to a bit like the example you gave a moment ago, you know, of knowing the answer in a spelling test or just seeing, you know, an electric, you know, seeing letters just in neon in her mind. It would just be there.
But I mean, yes, okay. I mean, well, the mind is a weird thing. I mean, I made a film about people who hear voices and they were wonderfully interesting people because, you know, generally if people hear voices, people say they're mad. And I put this to them and one of them was very charming and slightly exasperated. And he said, look, if you're mad, you'll have mad voices. If you're sane, you'll have sane voices.
Yeah.
And the sane voices told them, they said, things they didn't know. The voices were cleverer sometimes than they were.
No, and one of the people that I interviewed for the book is a very brilliant psychiatrist at Cornell University who works on the psychiatry of delusions. And he was really interesting to talk to. He says, because I'm an academic psychiatrist rather than a practicing kind of doctor psychiatrist, people will tell me much stranger stuff because I'm not going to try and treat them or make them better. I just want to hear. But he made the observation that we're amazingly able to have extreme delusions or ideas about the world and just have them fit into an otherwise normal life. Do you know what I mean? You can believe that the CIA are trying to poison you and agree to meet someone in a cafe. Do you know what I mean? That's not, people will have these things right along, you know, so you can have mad voices or sane voices, and these sort of points of distinction are really obvious to the person who maintains them. Yeah.
If you had a premonition, let's not use the word premonition, if you woke up one day and you just knew something.
Yeah.
What would you do with it? I mean, would you just say, I can't know that because it is at odds with my broader worldview of rationality? Yeah. Or would you say, I know this?
Oh.
Like if I don't know, you had a premonition that your best friend, if they got on the plane they were going to get on, was going to die, would you just say nothing?
Well, I think this is kind of what the book is about. You know, there's this nice bit of writing by Arthur Koestler, the writer of Darkness at Noon, who then became very, very occupied by the question of coincidence and chance and moved to the UK after the war and did a bunch of kind of experiments along these lines, exactly the same time as Barker. And he described this as a, you know, it's a mute power tugging at your sleeve, you know, these moments happening, and it's up to you to decide what you're going to do about it. Do you just kind of brush it off and kind of carry on with your life regardless, or do you see that as an opportunity to change or to do something? And I think we're making these judgments constantly. You know, we leave the house, you know, we see two magpies, we, you know, we treading some dog shit on the way to the tube? Do you know what I mean? Are we going to have a bad day, or are we going to manage to compartmentalize that? And kind of, we're constantly evaluating signals and patterns and choosing to follow them and choosing to disregard them. There's all these splits all the time. And the Premonitions Bureau, you know, this was, you know, it featured, you know, it's got a bunch of people in it who decided to, you know, listen to the tug and to change and to see where it went.
Yeah, because you, in a way, there are two extreme worldviews, aren't they? And you talk about this, I think it's page 86, a world without accidents is also a world of hidden strings and predestined lives. And it is these two extreme views. If there are no patterns and everything is without meaning, and it's all coincidence and random, that's an extreme view of the world. And the other one is there are none. There are hidden strings and cabals, but neither one really fits happily. So it's onto the way that we think of reality. So we're all sort of somewhere in the middle, aren't we?
Yeah. I completely agree. I think that's a really good description.
Hey there. I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay. Jan says, what would it take for you, brackets both, to accept or believe in premonitions? You first.
Oh, great. That's a really good question.
Your book.
What would it take?
Yeah.
You know, I think the cheating answer is that it would have to happen to me. It would have to happen to yourself. You'd have to have the kind of the experience in your own mind. I mean, I think it's one of those fascinating questions that, in the broadest frame, I find my own kind of rational defenses against it, you know, breaking down. You know, J.B. Priestley, who's kind of a great popularizer of problems around time, with his plays, which all kind of, you know, have complicated kind of versions of time in them. He wrote this book, Man and Time, in 1964, steeped in more or less exactly the same kind of intellectual climate as Barker and the other kind of people in the book. And he writes about a rope fraying at both ends. He says, you know, we know that time doesn't work at the planetary scale because of relativity, and we know that time doesn't work at the subatomic scale because of quantum physics. And why on earth should human life be the only life in which time functions in this remorselessly boring way? He talks about, you know, we're living with the poorest notion of time that we've ever had. You know, much older civilizations had much more complicated and nuanced understandings of time because it was clearly a mystery. Do you see what I mean? This ultra-rationalist kind of reading, and I, you know, it was, you know, writing and reporting on a subject like this and talking to people, I'd always get really worried talking to, you know, people like physicists or people like neurologists or neuroscientists. And they were really into it as a general rule. There wasn't, you know, I think there's certainly a time in the kind of a couple of decades earlier, I think the kind of the big counterattack against, you know, ESP and the occult really kind of got going in the 1970s, where this stuff was driven out of university campuses and strange little institutes, you know, couldn't get funding. And you know, there was a real active attempt to shut this stuff down because it was bad for people's minds. I think that attitude has kind of loosened a little now. If you kind of, you know, if you read, you know, Carlo Rovelli, the Italian physicist, and stuff like that, there's really, you know, wonderful and baffling stuff in there. Yeah.
Yes, but
You're dodging the question.
Oh, sorry. I'm not sure anyone really cares whether I I'm just going to gloss over that. I mean, it's your book, not mine. But there's another, you mentioned in passing these gruesome experiments, this swimming jar for rats, where they just make a rat swim round and round and see how long it takes before the rat gives up and drowns. It was the kind of experiment they used to do back in the 60s and 70s, along with things like Harlow's monkeys, nightmare experiments. But then if you lift the show the rat that they might be taken out, and you then they don't give up so early, and you have a little phrase you say, if you eliminate hopelessness, and there's something very, that's a very rich phrase, isn't it? That because lots of people's lives are filled with hopelessness, and they can be overcome with hopelessness, and rationally you can feel very hopeless.
Yeah.
Like if your factory, the only factory in your town, has been closed down, or some politician decided to close all the mines and there's nothing you can do, rationally you could feel hopeless.
Yeah.
And yet you need to have some irrational sense, a premonition or an intuition, something deeply irrational that prevents you from just going, oh, I thought it then, I'll just lay down and die.
Yeah.
So the irrational is useful.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it's necessary, and it's sort of, and as a,
but about the future, like something will come up.
Yeah.
Your granny says, don't worry, son, something will come up.
Yeah. And that's fate often, isn't it? You know, that's how people kind of talk about it. And that's what, you know, I do mean it when I think that there is something innately social in a premonition. I know it's not it's not the first thing that you might think of, but it does hint at something collective and something human and something shared. And so, you know, and I think the kind of an irrational but good response to hopelessness is not feeling abandoned and not feeling alone to these forces that are out of our control. Do you know what I mean?
Hmm. Yes. And it brings us back to things like intuition, because we were saying, you know, that someone who makes a prediction, but you feel it's based on a lot of knowledge, like the engineer who predicts that the train is not safe, is different to the dance teacher who predicts a fire in a hospital. But intuitions sort of lie in between, because an intuition often does go way beyond what you think the person could reasonably have come up with based on their knowledge. And that somehow they make this leap, they intuit something. So is intuition sort of in that family, but somehow it hasn't been driven out yet? Or do you think that there are lots of people who are suspicious of intuitions? Do they work? Do you have intuitions?
Yeah, I kind of, I, how would I answer that in my own experience? I'd probably just dodge this one with a tiny bit of, you know, Socrates and his daimon, you know, his voice in his head. Mm. And his was a voice in his head, his clairvoyant spirit only spoke to say, no, don't do that. It didn't say yes. It didn't point to things that he couldn't know. It would just warn him of bad things. And I think that's a form of intuition that I can relate to. I mean, certainly kind of, you know, in my, you know, day job as a reporter, all of these things are true, but it's like, it's always worth that last phone call when, you know, they haven't been picking up. It's always worth knocking on that other door. It's always worth that extra bit. Do you know what I mean? And you're constantly sort of looking for sort of slivers of things that then kind of are borne out. I don't know, you know, that's just a version of intuition from my working life, but I'm sure people have, you know, their own versions of those.
Hmm. And intuitions are, would you say, intuitions are better than 50-50.
We should open it. The Intuitions Bureau. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, that would probably be very good. Have they been done in other countries? I mean, apart from America, I mean, you know, you can, would the Germans have a premonitions bureau? I think you mentioned something like it in the book.
So there have been, you know, different versions of these experiments have sort of, you know, come about. You know, the French army was very interested in premonitions during the First World War because it seemed like so many soldiers at the front line were having presentiments or kind of, you know, again, you know, classic, you know, a classic case where it's certainly not irrational to have, you know, vivid visions of sort of terrible things happening, but also, you know, a clash of kind of modernity and modern progress and, you know, stress. So the French army did a study during the First World War. I don't know if it's the one that you're referring to, but Charlotte Barat, a German Jewish woman in the 1930s, started collecting people's dreams and didn't tell them she was doing it. So the conversation would either kind of end up about dreams or she would kind of gently kind of nudge people in that direction and then go home and write about them and make this collection of 300 or so dreams all recorded in the first couple of years after the Nazis came to power in 1933. And some of those are kind of incredibly prophetic and ghastly and strange. And that was similarly to Barker, she used a kind of this language of seismology. You know, could you, were dreams or visions some kind of sensor of a subconscious or the future before it happened?
Yeah, I mean, all of those seem like they're more tractable for a semi-rational explanation than premonitions. Yeah. There's something, I mean, you chose premonitions wisely because it is the most difficult one because it, it fingers some very definite thing.
Yeah.
A plane which is going to fall out of the sky or... And I suppose you could still say, well, I mean, planes do fall out of the sky, but they're much more specific than that.
Yeah, and there are, you know, and there are a few, you know, examples in the book which just sort of are what they are, you know, on a kind of, you know, on a Wednesday morning in October 1967, you know, Miss Middleton suddenly overcome with a kind of depression, sits down in her kitchen and writes to the Premonitions Bureau that she thinks there's going to be a train crash and she can see the words Charing Cross. And then Sunday evening, 4 days later, an express train, you know, comes off the rails 8 miles outside Charing Cross and 49 people are killed. It's hard to sort of, you can explain it with the law of large numbers and say that, you know, in a population of 20 million people, someone will have a vision of something that then comes to pass and that, you know, someone wins the lottery every week, it happens. But, you know, some of the kind of experiences that happened are right at the edge of explanation, shall we say.
Yes. And as you say, even if you don't want to sign up to the reality of premonitions in their strongest form, you know, the stuff on the Scottish Islands was just wonderful as, you know, this is long before people started a sort of semi-scientific resurrection of all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And it is, as you say, just very deeply social. And the fascinating thing is when, as you say, when they went away from the island, it stopped.
Yeah.
And when they came back, it started again.
So
it's definitely tied to a community. It's not an individual thing.
Yeah, that's how, you know, that's the thing that I really take from it. And in that, you know, in that sense, you know, how strongly does it differ from religious experience and shared spiritual experiences that, you know, that people have? Yeah.
Do you think it's going to that we would do well to re-embrace some tolerance for this sort of thing, not necessarily just premonitions, but you know, voices and premonitions and intuitions and that sort of whole family of experiences which don't fall within the sort of AI number crunching worldview?
I think that you sort of, you know, I tried to write this book quite in quite a sort of restricted way in terms of the time period where it happened and what the people in the story wrote down and said about their experiences. You know, I really didn't want to extrapolate from the facts. But one of the things that I think's important is to sort of think about, well, what was driving this thinking? What were these guys reaching for? And, you know, in Barker's case, this was certainly about expanding a notion of what psychiatry is. You know, in his case, you know, he was in a mental hospital where some people had been, you know, locked up for 40 or 45 years, locked up as teenagers. Some people just with severe learning difficulties were just being locked away in places. And he was in his day job taking locks off doors and dismantling railings and bringing jazz bands into the hospital just for a bit of kind of variety and humane treatment. But on the other hand, he thought that these questions of intuition and premonitions and the nocebo effect were kind of, you couldn't separate that from what it is to be a psychiatrist and to understand what the human mind is capable of on a good day and what it's capable of on a bad day. So it expressed itself in this eye-catchy and kind of wacky and kind of ultimately somewhat kind of doomed experiment, but the place where it was coming from was basically kind of tolerant and good in a way. And, you know, one of the people that I came across in my research was an American psychiatrist called George Engel, who was occupied by almost a kind of eerily identical set of questions. He was fascinated by people who dropped dead seemingly out of fear. He was being closely following the Aberfan disaster and the kind of the consequences of that. He was really kind of almost the American version of Barker. And yet he never set up a premonitions bureau, but in the 80s, he became something of a kind of pioneer for what he called a kind of biopsychosocial model of medicine, which was taking a much broader view of people's environmental factors, their education, much more of not seeing past the malady, as it were, and seeing right into people's kind of environmental and social context. So you can start off heading towards some very kind of eccentric notions, and you can just sort of take a tiny angle at the right time and end up being the sort of person that has lecture halls named after you and kind of something of a kind of hero of modern psychiatry, or you can be forgotten like John Barker. Yeah.
Well, John Barker's not forgotten now because he comes alive in your book. I wish we could carry on discussing it, but we can't, I'm afraid, Sam. We've run out of time. But listen, thank you so much for talking to us. And and if you want to read about these wonderful people, they're in there. And they're all not forgotten now, thanks to Sam. Sam, thanks very much for chatting to us.
I appreciate it.
This episode of the How To Academy podcast starred Sam Knight and was presented by David Malone. It was produced by Luke Nailapero, and the series is exec produced by me and Dana Outcult. Come and see Sam live with Michael Lewis on the 7th of June. The discount code again is HowToPod. I hope to see you there, but if you can't make it in person, it's available as a live stream too. Until next time, I'm Vas Christodoulou. Thanks for listening.